From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in August of 2017 when President Donald Trump announced his administration's strategy for Afghanistan. Trump had campaigned on pulling the United States entirely out of Afghanistan. He called it a mess, a disaster, said he would happily end the commitments there. But he essentially changed his mind. Here's what the president wrote about Afghanistan in August of 2017. Quote, "My original instinct was to pull out, and historically I like following my instincts. But all my life, I have heard that decisions are much different when you sit behind the desk in the Oval Office. In other words, when you are President of the United States. So I studied Afghanistan in great detail and from every conceivable angle. After many meetings over many months, we held our final meeting at Camp David with my cabinet and generals to complete our strategy," end quote. And the bottom line to the Trump policy was, as noted by analysts, several thousand more troops, no real change in American policy there. Status quo, for the most part. And that has been the Trump policy just about everywhere in that region. Mike Azenko from the Royal Institute of International Affairs recently wrote that, quote, "Trump has now expanded U.S. military presence and or airstrikes in every combat theater that he inherited from Obama," end quote. This hour, we welcome a guest who can help us understand what's happening in the Persian Gulf, in Afghanistan, and other countries. Ambassador Ronald Newman served as U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. Before that, he served posts as ambassador to Bahrain, ambassador to Algeria, and deputy assistant secretary of state for Near Eastern Affairs. He currently serves as the president of the American Academy of Diplomacy, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank that touts the value of diplomacy, and he's the author of The Other War, Winning and Losing in Afghanistan, a book exploring political and military issues of Afghanistan. Ambassador, welcome to Connections. Great to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Don't forget also 16 months in Iraq. Afghanistan was my reward.
Was your reward. Is that right? Before the program began, you said, I think only half jokingly, that being retired now, you can speak just about as freely as you like, so we've got a lot to talk about here.
We're on.
Okay. The ambassador, by the way, is in Rochester as a guest of the local chapter of the World Affairs Council, and they work very hard to bring in guests from international posts serving here and around the world, and it's always interesting and instructive to hear their points of view. So I'd like to ask you right out of the gate here, as we talk about the work that you're doing now. One of the things you're doing is working on the value of diplomacy. You said that's your day job.
That is my day job.
Working on the value of diplomacy. Does the world still see the value of diplomacy?
Yes, I think the world as a whole does. I think a lot of Americans actually do, but have very little idea of what it means or what the reality is. And maybe that didn't matter too much until you had an administration that wanted to cut the budget by 30%.
Which administration was that? This one?
This one, okay. Which the Congress has bipartisan refusal in the Congress to do that for the last 2 years. But it makes it a more important issue, I think, for Americans to understand some of that reality.
Well, it was in 2014 when Afghanistan was electing a new president. And you were sort of on the interview circuit, having served as U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, having written the book on Afghanistan. And one of the things you said at the time was that diplomacy still must be part of the calculation for the United States, and that we in the past have essentially just threatened, well, we'll leave you. We will leave Afghanistan.
Yeah,
clean up your act. Clean up, you know, the training of your military and your security forces and everything else. And you said that hadn't worked. The diplomatic calculation must still be part of it. Can I ask you why that hasn't worked and how you assess that in Afghanistan? In other words, if this is a country that we've spent years in now, why hasn't it been effective to say to them, look, we cannot do this permanently, and that you must be on your own at some point? Why hasn't that worked?
Mostly because it's never been credible, one. And the second thing is it's very bad to run a bluff. You know, if you really mean it, if you really mean you're going to leave, that's one thing. You know, that might work out badly if you have to do it and you have your interest to pay. But most of the time when we've done that, we have not meant it. We have the conundrum. I was just back in Afghanistan earlier. Well, it's now last month, November.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a conundrum there. On the one hand, a lot of pieces of the policy are not working very well. On the other hand, the dangers that brought us to Afghanistan still exist. You still have al-Qaeda, somewhat reduced, but lashed up with the Taliban. Now you have the Islamic State, which has installed itself in a couple of parts of Afghanistan, has been tough enough to survive attacks both from us and from the Taliban, actually, has the potential for recreating itself. It has not brought in too many foreign fighters yet, but it could be the place where they reorganize after Iraq and Syria, and it certainly has plenty of vengeance toward us to go around. So you have this conundrum. On the one hand, you got a lot of problems with the policy. On the other hand, you've got some real risks to the homeland, and it's difficult to say, well, you know, I know I might get shot from there, but heck, I'm tired. I want to go home.
Well, they have a president who's been there since 2014. Well, a president who's been back in Afghanistan since I think 2002, served in various posts, and Ashraf Ghani elected in 2014. At the time, you said, when he was running against Abdullah Abdullah, who is a name that Americans would know pretty well, going back to, I think, his work with the Northern Alliance, predating the campaign in 2001 in Afghanistan. So these are names that are, as you noted, sort of pro-Western, or at least Western-friendly. And so Americans, to the extent that we know anything about Afghanistan, and I will put my hand in the air and say I know virtually nothing, the hope was that this pro-Western leadership would at least yield some kinds of international partnerships, some sort of forward momentum in the economic building, et cetera. How has the administration of Ghani unfolded?
Well, the pro-Western part's fine. I mean, Ghani's a good partner. Ghani's problems are twofold with the kind of third ancillary. He has not done well as a ruler of Afghanistan. It's a very unpopular government. People welcomed him with a lot of expectation, and they don't, whether it's fair or not, and some of it may be unfair, they don't feel they have had the development in governance they wanted. At the same time, security has gotten worse. It isn't going totally down the drain, but it is not good. Taliban control more than they did a few years ago. Again, it's nothing in Afghanistan is one picture. You know, if you like a really simple bottom line, go find another issue. This one just won't be it. But the fact is that security has gotten worse. So that's the third problem. That, of course, is the economics, because it's not Ghani has actually put in place some reforms that are significant. Tax collection is better. Various parts of the financial management have met IMF targets and are in improvement. But when you have poor security, people aren't really inclined to risk their own money. So it's very difficult to see that you can have an economic improvement without improving the security, some of which is a problem, of course, of Pakistan, from whence Taliban's not exclusively a Pakistani outfit, but it has a lot of support. It has base areas in Pakistan. But the quality of governance has not been what it should be. A lot of Ghani's supporters have deserted him, gone into opposition. Several are now running against him. So it's a troubled government. But everything is, you know, a bit of this and a bit of that. They just had a parliamentary election. I don't know if you want me to keep on talking.
No, go ahead.
But
please do.
This was, again, a kind of a mix, because on the one hand, first of all, you had the parliamentary election. The Afghans had to secure it themselves. They didn't have 100,000 foreign troops helping out the way they had in their last election. Now, there were more areas where they couldn't hold the election, but overall, they brought it off. The people came out and voted. They wanted this election. I talked not just the official statistics, which I treat with a certain reserve, but a pretty cynical bunch of journalists that I was meeting with last month. And they all said they were surprised how many people turned out. And this was despite not just threats of violence, but polling places being mortared. You know, Americans don't have to worry about getting mortared at the polling place when they go. Afghans still came out to vote. They did their part. The government was a mess. The administration of the polling was a mess. They had biometric devices, but they bought into that very late, didn't get properly trained, didn't get them all out where they needed to be. Voting rolls were confused. So, you know, which part do you like? The people did well. The government did badly. They've got a presidential election coming up in 5 months. I think that will happen. I don't think it will be delayed. But they've got a lot of work to do to somewhat clean up the act.
Okay. And in your book, and the book that you wrote on Afghanistan was published, I think, in 2009. But I think the themes are still so relevant today as we assess what's happening there. And I want to quote from your book, and you can talk more about how we decide when is enough enough and how do we decide that a change in policy would be hasty. You wrote the following, quote, "If we do not understand how much time is needed for accomplishment, we are drawn too often to give up ideas when we have only begun a process to put them into effect," end quote. And your book opens with this admonition, and it concludes with this admonition that we've got to be careful not to cut and run too quickly before you give real efforts a chance to flower. Well, that was in 2009. It's 2018 heading into 2019. Have we given it enough time?
I would say no, but, you know, you will understand, and listeners have to understand, I have skin in this game. I've been part of this policy process. So there are two, when you say we've given enough time, there are two questions. One is, can you afford to leave? Well, the three, can you afford to leave? Can you sustain it? Do you have any chance of succeeding? I would argue the most fundamental is, can you afford to leave? Can you afford the level of risk to the country of Al-Qaeda and of the Islamic State and of disintegration and of various other Islamic rebel movements that are in Afghanistan that expand instability into Central Asia? I would say, over from my view, overall, the answer is no. Others might have a different perspective. The second point is, can you sustain it? Well, it's tough, and it's expensive. But when you come right down to it, it costs us about a little less than 1% of our defense budget. So it's real money, but yes, that is a sustainable cost. We have a very low level of casualties there now. Afghans are dying. They're carrying most of the battle. We're losing a few people, and that's tragic, but you know, if you put 15,000 troops at a base, you'd probably be losing almost as many people in drunk driving incidents on busy weekends as we're losing in combat deaths. So, I mean, that's a hard thing to say. But all I'm saying is, yes, if you want to sustain it politically, it is sustainable. Third question is, do you have any hope? Well, yes, but I'm not going to argue this is any kind of certainty. When you see the American University of Afghanistan, when you see the graduates, the students who a year ago were out because they was attacked by the Taliban, 14 people were killed, including a crippled girl who was shot twice crawling up a stair and who went to the States for surgery and is back to finish her degree at the university. I mean, those people are inspiring. They tell you that there is another Afghanistan possible. They don't guarantee it'll happen. And you see the improvements, there's a lot that's wrong. But when you think that, 18 years ago, there was no education system. There were less than 1 million children in school. None of them were girls. There was no higher education system at all. There were virtually no university graduates left in Afghanistan because the entire system had melted down. So If you weren't in the middle of a war, you'd say actually the post-war recovery of this country is pretty impressive. Trouble is, you are in the middle of a war. But there is some progress there as well.
Well, and there are questions about if we truly pull out the vast majority of our forces, what happens there? And one of the ideas is you create a safe haven for terrorist enterprises. And again, let me quote from Mike Azenko from Chatham House, who wrote this just this morning. He wrote, quote, "After 17 years of war in Afghanistan, the safe haven myth continues to justify U.S. military presence in combat operations. That assumption that has only grown and become more unquestioned in the Pentagon," end quote. And so what Azenko is saying is he doesn't believe it, that this idea that we have to stay there because you've got the Islamic State taking up their own portion, the Taliban, of course, Al-Qaeda in some form, and ejecting ourselves from the mix there creates more safe haven for them to do what they need to do, and we become more vulnerable here on our own soil, as we saw in 9/11. He's saying he doesn't believe that. Do you believe that?
Yeah, actually, I do believe it. I mean, he uses myths, but this is a matter of, can you prove what will happen in the future if you get out? No, but you'll only get it wrong once. Personally, with a sustainable cost, and what I would judge to be a serious risk, I would rather pay the cost and diminish the risk. If you're wrong and you have another 9/11 or you have other terrorist actions launched from there, you're not going to get to go back and do it over. So, you know, yes, I appreciate the fact that he has a strong opinion and a strong willingness to risk other people's lives, but I don't happen to agree with him.
Okay, and then going based on the model that your book sets forth, which is that we need to be, you know, sort of careful before we rush out or we pivot too quickly and we allow these ideas and these initiatives to take time to develop, what is the metric that prevents us from being there forever? What's the metric that tells you there is enough success or there is a beyond just the safe haven concern for terrorists? What are the metrics that tell you on the ground in Afghanistan we are in the direction that says, okay, this is imperfect, but there is value in being here?
Well, the next metric that will come up will be the presidential election in Afghanistan. That's 5 months away. Now, they're either going to get that somewhat better, or they're going to replay their last election in 2014 with massive fraud and political crisis. I've warned Afghan friends that I don't think America still has the willingness or desire to come save them if they dig themselves a hole that big. They might provide the political cover for us to leave. But that's a fairly immediate test we're going to have. If they can pull that one off, at least somewhat better, you could have a stronger government. I don't know if they will. But it's certainly premature to pull the plug before that. I would say also, you get this recurring theme of, you've done this for 17 years, why don't you know it won't work? To which the first answer is, there's no one thing we've been doing for 17 years. The Obama administration changed policy 5 separate times, and they continued to signal an early release with these dates, which encouraged the Taliban, discouraged Afghans. They brought this nearly to the brink of failure with highly unrealistic restrictions. You know, from 2014 to November 2016, 2 years, we were not allowed to use air power in support of the Afghan army. We trained them with us to fight with air power. And for 2 years, Taliban, unless they were overrunning a city, could walk around and consolidate and wave at the airplanes that weren't allowed to shoot at them. Now, I think some of those policies of the Obama years, frankly, were downright dumb. And they seriously retarded the effort. So one of the reasons that it's so much harder now is you're trying to go back, particularly in the military training, and do right what you did wrong. And we tried to build a much larger army in about 3 years. You look at our deployment of forces, and it looks kind of like a flattened roller coaster. We had about 2 years really concentrated getting troops in, about 3 years there, and we started taking them out. So this simple argument, it's, you know, shows you can't do it, is actually a vast simplification of a very badly managed policy.
Okay. How would you assess the Trump administration's work so far? And let's start with those who have been leading the international efforts. You were a little harsh before the program began about Mr. Tillerson, yes?
I was harsh, and I am harsh about Mr. Tillerson in the management of the State Department, where I think he did enormous damage to professional diplomacy. Policy, one would differ on different policies, but I think actually Trump administration has come to a more comprehensive policy than the Obama administration. Big question with the Trump administration is, will they stick to it? You know, everybody looks over their shoulder and wonders whether you wake up to a tweet in direction, and that's uncertain. But what they're trying to do is more comprehensive in terms of a more unified strategy, a regional dimension of pressure on Pakistan, the building of the army. There is an element in Trump's policy that's not very much noticed. It's one of the things that makes it difficult to explain policy in short, because he has a line in his speech when he announced the policy saying that it's not totally unconditional. The Afghans have to do their piece.
Sure.
But that means you're trying to explain a policy where we're not planning a departure. We don't have a deadline, but yes, we actually might leave if you people screw it up and don't get with it. Now, that is not a, I don't think that's a contradiction of the policy. That is a tension inherent in what you're trying to do. If the Afghans will not triumph over some of their intestine feuding, this will fail in the end. You can't get away from that. But you don't want to have these artificial deadlines. So that tension's inbuilt to the policy, but it sure makes it hard to have a bumper sticker kind of approach to explaining it.
Okay. Why did you say that when he was in office, Tillerson hurt the cause of diplomacy?
Because of a number of things. This gets a little wonky, so I'll ask pardon in advance.
It's okay. But we like wonky here.
He came in determined to reduce the numbers of the size of the State Department that was dictated by the White House. He had, and the White House had no plan for what it was they wanted to produce. They just wanted cuts. So in the process of cutting, we lost about 25% of our senior officers, the 4- and 3-star equivalent level particularly. And with that goes a lot of experience, which you can't rebuild quickly. So we lost a lot of our bench. We cut back on the number of diplomats coming into the Foreign Service. Foreign Service is like the military. You come in at the bottom, but it's no lateral entry. So, like the military, if you don't bring in enough lieutenants now, in 10 years you don't have enough majors, in 20 years you don't have enough colonels. So that hurt. They put on a hiring freeze, which is fine if it is like stop the trains while we figure out the schedule. A year later, you got half your trains on the siding. That's not good. So in this hiring freeze, you couldn't move a person. If you lost somebody from a critical job, you couldn't move somebody from a less critical job unless you got the Secretary of State to sign off for an exemption. So you had massive distortions. The bureau that handles Afghanistan, India, Bangladesh with the refugees was missing 25% of its civil servants after a year. The Foreign Affairs Foreign Service Institute, where we do all our training, they were short 167. Well, now Pompeo comes in, he lifts the hiring freeze, and he discovers he hasn't got enough money, he hasn't got enough authorization for personnel just to put things back. So now he's got to take what he's gotten in authorization and figure out how much he's got, split it up over 50-odd bureaus. They've got to figure out what their hiring priorities are. So we do training at the Foreign Service Institute. You're short 167 people. Good. Now they've got authority to bring back 19. Well, let's figure out which 19 are. So this is becomes very hard to unwind. And there are a number of systemic distortions like this that occurred under Tillerson that are just painfully damaging. We've lost experience. We've lost capacity. And you can build some of that back, but you can't instantly, you can inflate promotion numbers, but you can't instantly recreate experience.
And what does that translate to?
You could tell I'm a little passionate about that.
I can. What does that translate? I certainly understand the concern we're losing experience. It could take, this is the kind of damage that could take a long time to unwind. But functionally, in terms of our relationships with other countries, their ambassadors, the kind of work that we're trying to accomplish, what are we either not there for or missing or bungling as a result of this?
Well, yeah, I want to distinguish between the things which are policy and the things which are the conduct of policy. Because policy ultimately is the president. And I might not like or agree with where this president goes in alliances, but he's elected by the American people. He's entitled to make that decision whether I agree with it or not. Question is carrying it out. Now, there's a middle ground. This administration is singularly deficient in briefing people around the president who can explain what he's doing or what our policy is. And that's a kind of an in-between. I mean, that's a problem of how the White House organizes, a problem of how the president wants to work, makes diplomacy a little more difficult. Then you get down to we haven't filled a number under Tillerson, we hadn't filled a whole slug of the top jobs in the department. That means that everything was going up to him. People were going off to, who were going off to international conferences sometimes didn't know until a day or two before they got on the plane whether they were authorized to go or not, because the decision to authorize the travel funds was being made by the Secretary of State. At one point, I was told by a person who works on the field that there were over 100 memos requiring action that were all waiting for the secretary to act on them because he'd pulled delegation of authority from various other people and hadn't redelegated it. Well, you know, at that point, you just got a traffic jam.
Talking to a former ambassador to Afghanistan. Go ahead.
You asked if I was frank. I hope we've answered all of that question.
I think so. It's always nice to talk to people who are retired. Those are the most enjoyable interviews.
I was pretty frank even when I was in. But maybe not about my immediate bosses in public.
The ambassador served as U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, as ambassador to Bahrain, Algeria, among others. And the work in Iraq that I don't want to mistake. What was the actual work in Iraq, by the way?
I was going up for 6 months to help Bremer be kind of a utility diplomat and run their foreign ministry. And then I was going to go back and finish in Bahrain. But then Ambassador Negroponte, who at that point I'd never met, called up late one night and asked me if I wouldn't like to stay for a year and be the main liaison between the embassy and the military. And so I, with some support from my wife, agreed to do that.
How can you say no when the country asks you to do something, right?
Well, I mean, we take the same oath. The Foreign Service takes the same oath the military take, oath to the Constitution. It's the first oath that the Continental Congress created for George Washington. And we have the same ethic of service.
Well, the ambassador is the guest in Rochester of the local chapter of the World Affairs Council. And after our only break of the hour, we're going to talk about some other issues that are relevant to his work and also, I think, international news. We've got some news out of Iran. There seems to be news all the time coming from there. So we'll talk about that and much more. And listeners, if you want to contribute, if you want to email the program, it's connections@wxxi.org. If you'd like to do that, you can call the program as well, and we will take your feedback as well. The ambassador with us for the rest of the hour after this only break. I'm Evan Dawson. On Wednesday, no new edition of Connections. Our broadcast will be preempted by national NPR coverage for the official services for President George H.W. Bush. The president passing away in recent days, and you will hear starting on Wednesday morning into the afternoon all of the coverage of the official services. That's Wednesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. As we just mentioned, tomorrow on the program, you'll get full coverage of the state funeral for President George H.W. Bush, who the ambassador told me before the program began, you knew his son better than President George H.W. Bush, yes?
Yes.
What did you make of President H.W. Bush as a leader, a man who served in various capacities?
And he was one of the most accomplished diplomatic leaders, I think, of the post-war period. You know, it's interesting commentary just about how we pick our presidents. We have only had three presidents since World War II who came into office with any background in foreign affairs. Natural because it's not what we focus on in our elections, but we happen to be a global country that picks leaders without any relevance or expectation that they'll actually know anything about that. It's all on-the-job training.
And he was the last of
he was the last.
Eisenhower, Nixon. Nixon and George H.W. Bush.
George H.W. Bush had been CIA director and ambassador at the UN, all the rest.
Well, let's look a little bit at Iran before I read some feedback from listeners here. And there's certainly a lot of different things I could ask you about Iran just in terms of understanding their nuclear program and what is appropriate and what is not. But just from CNN yesterday, let me just go ahead and read the latest reporting from CNN on this. Quote, the United States is calling on the European Union to enact its own set of sanctions targeting Iran following Tehran's test of a missile this past weekend. Brian Hook, the State Department official who oversees policy in Iran, said on Monday, quote, we would like to see the European Union move sanctions that target Iran's missile program specifically. Hook spoke during a flight with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to a meeting of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in Brussels. Agree or disagree with that?
I think the missile program is a problem, but I also think that the way we are going about it is unlikely to get much support from the Europeans, although they will be somewhat concerned. I think Iran, in certain respects, is a real threat. I think the fact that we continually exaggerate the threat and want a color only in one shade for many others simply diminishes the credibility. So we're a little bit like the old story of the boy crying wolf. We have a little when you have a real threat, we have problems getting attention because we've exaggerated so many other things.
What would you say about the deal that was struck on the nuclear program there in general? Did you support it?
Yes, I did. I thought it had flaws, but it was the best deal that I thought, as much as one could tell. It did stop them from moving forward. They were very close to where they could have produced a nuclear weapon. It set them back for a long way. It was not wholly adequate. It is simply not clear that anything we are doing now has them under any more restraint. Really, what's keeping them now is simply that they think right now they've got us more isolated than the Europeans, and they'd like to keep it that way.
Why is it that this administration claims that that deal did not set Iran back, that did not stop them at all?
They didn't claim that it didn't stop them at all. They claimed that it was inadequate in terms of the inspections. I think that's debatable. They focused, as many did, on the fact that certain parts of the deal had a sunset provision that would end after a number of years. And they focused also on this business of ballistic missiles because the agreement itself did not constrain the missiles. What you have now, you have a UN resolution which essentially says Iran shouldn't deploy, but it isn't a requirement. It's a sort of request. So the fact that Iran is now deploying and testing missiles is irritating, and it may be dangerous, but it is not actually a violation. And we're very sloppy with our terminology about that. Of course, it's easier to be sloppy in politics than in law.
Does the UN have the teeth that it needs to have?
No. There are certain resolutions in the UN, they're called Chapter 7 resolutions, which include the potential for the use of force by individual countries. UN doesn't have any armies. This is not a Chapter 7 resolution. It does not include any teeth. You have UN resolutions. The most effective UN resolutions, for instance, on sanctions, are effective because they constrain other countries to impose the sanctions. There is no such UN resolution in this case.
I don't know if there have been harsher critics of the UN than John Bolton, and as someone yourself who...
That would be hard.
Okay. So as someone yourself who champions the value of diplomacy, and again, that's the ambassador's day job now with the organization known as the American Academy of Diplomacy in Washington, has John Bolton been a net negative or positive for the cause of diplomacy?
You know, that's a little hard to evaluate from outside. The job of the National Security Advisor is quite different from being a commentator, and you have to be a kind of honest broker in making sure the president gets multiple options, that he gets to hear what the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense are trying to tell him. I don't know. What is interesting, I think, so far is you have not had any stories that Bolton is tilting one way or the other, cutting somebody out, as you have had with some national security advisors. And so I don't know that that's proof, but it's kind of the dog that didn't bark if you're a Sherlock Holmes follower. And so it may be some evidence that he is doing this job as he's supposed to. He obviously has his own views, but I have not seen any, heard any evidence in the press that his views are preventing other views from reaching the president.
Are you suggesting that when people take media jobs, their histrionics amplify and that they become a little more bombastic and combative?
Well, that seems to
sell. I could never imagine that, Ambassador.
I'm sure you couldn't. There does seem to be, it's just interesting to watch talk shows if you have a high tolerance for people yelling at each other without wanting to listen to a debate.
I imagine you don't have much tolerance for that because, and I will say this again, not to be condescending to cable news, because I wouldn't want to be involved in a shouting match about foreign policy because I don't know anything about foreign policy.
That doesn't deter a great many people.
It doesn't deter. That's the thing that drives me crazy is watching these debates about people who have such limited information or outdated information or no information at all, speaking with such certainty.
Well, you asked whether I sometimes was blunt. I will tell you that once I was on a video conference from Baghdad, and the video people on the Washington end were going on, and one fellow from a different agency began by saying, "I don't really know about this question. It's not mine, but I have a question," at which point, not being terribly guarded about having the microphone off, I said from Baghdad, "Then why don't you shut up?"
How'd that go over?
Well, all of a sudden, there's about a 5-second delay,
yeah,
in those conversations. So there was this little delay, and then all the heads in Washington on the camera were swiveling, looking at us. We just kind of sat there.
I guess it's a fair question. Well, in the interest then of bluntness, who is the U.S. president that has impressed you most with diplomacy or approach to foreign policy? Is it George H.W. Bush?
Yes. I mean, I think you'd have to think hard about
some. I would say in your work career, by the way.
In my work career. I mean, you'd have to think hard about Nixon's opening to China and some fundamentals of the Nixon presidency. But I think the soft ending of the Cold War, the unification of Germany, and the putting together the coalition to drive Saddam out of Kuwait, those are really magnificent accomplishments of the Bush president, the 41 HW.
What individual president has impressed you the least?
The current one is having a real head start on that.
And why is that? Just sort of general ignorance?
I don't know why. I mean, we are tearing up our trade relations. It's not. I mean, these are questions people will argue about. We walked out of this negotiation for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, mm-hmm, and the 11 other states went ahead and finished an agreement without us that doesn't include a lot of concerns that we have. We're functioning on a basis that's very transactional, and that has some successes. You know, I think one has to give President Trump some credit. But at the same time, a lot of alliance relationships depend on trust. When you go with a purely transactional relationship that, you know, well, I'm going to see how much I get out of this one, what you do as a byproduct is to undercut any trust in your long-term dependability. And we are such a big power and are so important to the functioning of a great many international institutions that when people don't have confidence in our long-term views, orientations, then they begin to go in a whole lot of other directions, and you may not necessarily be able to put all those things back together.
This president does strike me as having a zero-sum worldview on just about everything, that there is almost nothing of possible synergy or mutual benefit, that it is almost always zero-sum in politics, in trade, economics. Does that strike you as accurate, And that an approach to trade, we must have partnerships that aim to be mutually beneficial?
Well, I think when things are mutually beneficial, they're more sustainable for the long run. But that's a kind of a difference between government and business in a way. Business, you can switch partners easier. You can switch national partners. Secondly, business domestically occurs within a framework of law. So there's something to fall back on. If you know, you don't have to be based purely on trust. That's why you hire a lot of lawyers, because you can enforce an agreement. International agreements really aren't enforceable in the same way. And certainly international behavior is not enforceable. So you have to have a higher level of trust. NATO, for instance, NATO doesn't actually oblige anybody to fight. It really only obliges you to consult, because that was done to go along with our constitutional requirements. But in fact, everybody believed that we would fight if Western Europe was attacked by the Soviets. So credibility is what essentially allowed Western Europe to come back from the disaster of World War II, recreate its economy, become our biggest trading partner in the world, and help us stabilize a number of other parts of the world. If you don't have trust, you can't manage those relations.
You've pointed to Afghanistan and threats of leaving in the past, which have been followed up by us not leaving, eroding our trust. Do you feel the same way about the Obama administration's so-called red line in Syria? Was that a mistake?
Oh, that was a huge mistake. And one of the interesting things after that was I would talk to people who were traveling in Asia, and they would come, or Africa, and they were telling me about conversations with local government officials lacking trust in the U.S. because we had not carried out what we said we were going to do in Syria. So it was interesting to see how far the ripples spread.
What about Syria today? I mean, you talk about complex problems. One of the themes, I think, of reading your work and having these conversations with you indicates to me that those who work in diplomacy understand that the world is much grayer than sort of the caricature black and white the media may portray, and I imagine Syria is a very complex problem.
Yeah, well, that's why diplomats aren't always popular, because they always want to talk about, well, the glass is half full, it's half
yes.
empty.
You know, we no, want you a, to just it's make actually, a decision.
It's
yes.
actually got a crack in it. You know. Syria is now a definition of a wicked problem, because we've had some pretty ineffective policies. We've lost a number of options. We've lost the option of overthrowing Assad. You know, he's basically won the war. We want to get the Iranians out, but it's not clear that anything we're doing has the potential to achieve that. We've got a number of policy goals that make perfectly good sense. We want the Iranians' influence reduced or out. We want the Islamic State removed. We want some kind of recognition or help for the people that have fought with us. Trouble is, the resources we're putting in don't accomplish any of those things. You know, we're keeping troops in Syria in order to thwart the Iranians, but our troops are hundreds of miles away from where the Iranians are. We have only 2,000-odd troops there. So my friend Jim Jeffrey is trying to work this out. I wish him a lot of luck. He's a good friend and he's a great diplomat. But this is one... This is a problem where we have enunciated goals, but there's a huge gap between ways and means, and we don't seem to be addressing that.
Why do you say that the removal of Assad is almost impossible now?
Because he won the war. He's taken back almost all of Syria. There are only about three enclaves that he has not fully reconquered with Russian help. One of those we're sitting on. And the others are in a kind of fragile ceasefire that may get broken at some point, almost certainly will. So there is no coherent force now to achieve Assad's overthrow, and we're not building one. I don't know that we could anymore. I think we passed the point where there were points where we might have done that. You can argue about whether or not we could have or not, but in any event, they're gone.
What is the biggest foreign policy blunder you've seen in your work career?
Who? Wow. Now, that takes more thinking than this, than we have time for today. you could say the biggest foreign policy blunder might have been Vietnam. That broke national... I don't know what would have happened if we had not gone in. But we had a lot of blunders. We almost permanently cratered the trust between the American government and the American people. I suppose the one good thing you can say about that is when you look at like Chicago in 68 with the riots and police beating people up, we're not yet quite that divided, so we know it can be. It's not as bad as it's ever been today. But in terms of the long-term consequences to the nation, I would at least on first blush, but I think somebody may come up with another idea in 5 minutes, and I'll say, oh, yeah, why didn't I think of that?
Okay. A listener named Dan points us to a piece that he read in The Intercept, which is a news outlet founded by Glenn Greenwald, who was the journalist who now lives in Brazil, who published the work of Edward Snowden. And The Intercept had this to say regarding Afghanistan. Well, I'll read Dan's email. He says, I can understand the logic that says it's more dangerous to leave Afghanistan or it's a better strategy to stay. However, when we entered Afghanistan almost 20 years ago now, the Taliban was smaller and weaker than it is now by some accounts, and ISIS did not exist at all. As Ryan Grimm points out in this Intercept piece, the Taliban tried to surrender to the United States almost 20 years ago, but the neocons and the Bush Bush administration refused to allow it. And they quote, he quotes from the piece, quote, "Before Trump spends the windfall he hopes to reap from mining Afghanistan, he should consider one startling reality. We are now losing a war to an enemy that already surrendered. That's not easy to do." That's from Dan.
That's basically correct.
Is that correct?
We went into Afghanistan, and I'm happy to say this before my watch. We went into Afghanistan on the simple mission of kill terrorists and al-Qaeda. We were not interested in stabilization. In fact, we rebuffed NATO when they offered more troops to help stabilize some places, but we were afraid they'd get in the way of our hunting terrorists. We wasted a major opportunity of the first couple of years. Well, yeah, he's correct. Doesn't solve your problem today, however.
Okay. I wonder if Dan, though, takes that failure and says it's hard to sort of trust the foreign policy establishment. To what extent is there an establishment? I think establishment's a word that's used to sort of paint this idea that there's this groupthink mentality in foreign policy, that whether it's a state, yeah, the American military, et cetera. Is there?
Well, I suppose there is some, because if you probably in any profession, if people work together on problems over time, they develop certain common views. The Obama administration was also very critical of this. You know, they referred to the blob. I think it was Ben Rhodes' comment. Well, except the Obama administration and a lot of its decisions revoking or not taking the advice of the blob, at least on Afghanistan, you know, where I can talk. They were told repeatedly these deadlines are a disastrous mistake. But they were not interested in that advice. They were not interested in the advice on Syria. So they probably got bad advice on some other things from the professionals, but certainly on some of the things that are regarded as the biggest mistakes of the Obama administration was when they went without using professionals. You can't make policy just with the professionals, because ultimately the American people elect their representatives. You can't forget that. And you want people who represent the president's views, and you want people who have new ideas. Where you need the professionals, though, is to tell you what won't work, to tell you how to package something so somebody will do what you want. You know, diplomacy is not about making nice. Diplomacy is about getting other people to do what you want and to like it so you can go back and get them to do what you want again.
That's a succinct way to put it for diplomacy.
That's what it's about.
So in our last couple of minutes then, do you think this president understands diplomacy as you'd like him to? And what would you say if you were in the room with this president and he said in a rare moment of sort of openness, "You know, Ambassador, I'm kind of ignorant about certain affairs. Help me see the world a little bit differently." What would you say to this president?
I have no idea. There's no sign that he takes that approach. I suppose if I had to say one thing, thinking quickly, it would be at least test ideas with professionals who can tell you what might not work before you latch onto them. Then if you want to go ahead, go ahead. But allow the debate so that you have a chance to avoid pitfalls. I mean, my definition of experience is simple. It's not having all your mistakes in front of you.
but isn't that the sort of interesting possible issue with this administration is that what the president is saying, and even perhaps what he wants to do or asserts that he wants to do, is not necessarily what's carried out by those serving in this administration. I mean, he can tweet whatever he wants, he can say what he wants, but the people who are actually executing policy may not
be... But this isn't a new problem. You know, Harry Truman, when Eisenhower was elected, said, "Poor Ike, he's been a general, now he's going to be president, he's going to say, do this and do that, and nothing will happen."
This is an age-old problem here?
Yeah, this is not a wholly new problem.
But is it a problem? Is that how it should be?
Well, I suppose that depends on where you sit and, you know, whether you think that ideas should be instantly occupied. But I would say from the point of view of the founders of our Constitution, since our whole system is based on checks and balances and restraint in order to allow free Americans to govern themselves, there is something to be said not for the efficiency of a system like that, but for the fact that it allows mature consideration of ideas.
And Mr. Ambassador, in our last 20 seconds or so, your work involve such education and world experience. And I'm concerned that myself, but also the rest of this country, is not very well educated on issues that are this intricate in that part of the world and in the Middle East where you've spent so much time. How can we do better with education?
Oh, Lordy. I think what we have to start with is civic education so we understand our own system, our own people. And then after that, you get into a very complex thing because the world's a big place and we have interests too many places for any one person to keep track of.
My guest, the ambassador, is the author of The Other War, Winning and Losing in Afghanistan. He served as ambassador to Afghanistan, Bahrain, Algeria, has done work in Iraq as deputy assistant secretary of state for Eastern Affairs, and more. And now the president of the American Academy of Diplomacy in Washington. Our thanks to Ambassador Newman, who is in Rochester as a guest of the local chapter of the World Affairs Council. I hope you have a good visit to Rochester. And
it's been great so far. Thanks very much.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, and Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and we're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.